The largest post-Cold War military buildup in the world is currently taking place in China, with most of the military technology coming from the United States. That's everything from computer chips and nuclear-capable missiles to night vision equipment, and little of it legally acquired. It's the subject of an article by Simon Cooper in this month's Popular Mechanics called China's Secret War, and it brings Jim Miggs, the magazine's editor-in-chief, to my show today. Hello.
Nice to be here.
Has all of China's military technology originated in the United States?
No, not all by any means. But over the last 15 years or so, China has put on a really determined effort to pick up some of the real high-tech items that they can't do on their own.
And that's despite the U.S. munitions list?
There are a lot of controls on this technology, and yet by decentralizing their spying effort, spreading out across a whole range of industries, they've been remarkably successful at picking up some of our best technology.
The munitions list is prohibits people from selling certain things to certain countries. So how did they get around that?
Well, one of the ways that China operates is not in the traditional cloak and dagger kind of spy mode that we're used to from the Cold War era. Instead, they tap into a vast network of people who might otherwise have totally legitimate jobs in academia or government or defense contractors or other areas, but where they might come in contact with something that China deems valuable. And at some point, a request comes out, maybe from a friend of a friend of a friend, and someone's asked, can you get us this chip? Can we take a look at these plans? And it's somewhat chaotic, it's somewhat disorganized, but over time they're able to put their hands on quite a bit of technology and then gradually piece it together back in China.
So these are not trained spies?
For the most part, they're not trained spies. So it's very different from our experiences, say, with the KGB.
And that gives them what's called a deniable distance. The Chinese government can say, I knew nothing about it. It was really some small company in Shandong that was doing this, and they contacted that man in America?
That's exactly what they do. In fact, we contacted the Chinese embassy, and they denied any involvement in espionage in the United States. But in a number of cases, the deniability is also enhanced by the fact these are dual-use technologies in some case. In some cases, they are things that might be on the watch list because they have an application in a cruise missile or some other technology, but they may also be a chip that you could use in a video game or some legitimate use.
And is that what they're saying? Oh, gee, we weren't even thinking about cruise missiles.
Well, in some cases where people have been caught in this country, that's part of their defense, is that they were engaged in a legitimate transfer of technology as opposed to hardcore espionage.
Tell me about Koswin Bill Mu.
Bill Mu, this case is actually somewhat unusual because he got caught in a very well-organized government sting that was put together by the U.S. Customs Department. But Bill Mu is a Korean-born arms trader who was probably the Taiwanese Air Force's best contact with the major U.S. arms makers. He was a sales consultant to Lockheed Martin and other companies, kind of a freelance broker.
And are these items on the munitions list available to Taiwan, but not to China?
In many cases, they would be, absolutely. So when he was finally arrested, he had a real shopping list from China that included a whole range of things. But he was able to put his hands on an F-16 engine, the latest generation, the GE turbofan F-16 engine, which is the most high-performance jet engine out there.
Well, how do you get your hands on
It was actually part of the sting. The government knew that he had it. Mm-hmm. So they were waiting for him to actually get the thing crated up. He had it crated up and ready to ship to China when they finally put a stop to the operation. But on his shopping list, China also was looking for an AGM air-launched cruise missile. That's a nuclear-capable cruise missile. They were looking for Black Hawk helicopter parts. They were looking for they were asking for nuclear submarine components or complete submarines. Now, that might be wishful thinking on their part, but it shows you how determined they are to lay their hands on this technology.
Now, I don't exactly understand why that's necessary. The Chinese have some pretty brilliant scientists. I would assume that with just a couple of years knowing how these things are working, basically, they could have come up with their own versions.
Well, in many cases, there's the core technology, and then there's how it's applied, how the chip is programmed, how it's all put together, and the effort that goes into that. For example, the Navy's Aegis battle management system. This is a system that helps them see if missiles are coming in for a threat. It helps them control all the aircraft they have deployed, keep track of all the ships, everything that's going on in the battle space. When China deployed their latest generation of destroyers last year, everyone in the Pentagon was taken aback to see that they had an Aegis weapon system that seemed to be a knockoff of our latest version. Now, early on, we did share some of that technology with them, but they have apparently been able to go in and essentially reprogram their computers with the new software. That's an easy way to kind of explain what they've done.
Would they prefer the actual machines, or would the blueprints be enough?
Well, in some cases, we're talking blueprints. Some cases, like with the F-16 engine, if they can get the item itself, they can reverse engineer it and do what China has done in a lot of other areas, which is to make a knockoff that's a lot less expensive but pretty darn effective.
My guest is Jim Meigs, M-E-I-G-S, the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics magazine, and no longer just publishing articles about how to put it together in your garage. This article is called China's Secret War, written by Simon Cooper. And you're listening to WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What does Sha Shu Jiang mean?
Sha Shu Jiang?
Yeah, I know the translation is silver bullet or assassin's mace.
Exactly. This is something.
Forgive
that
my bad Kent.
Yeah.
No, that would be Mandarin.
That's right. This is a term that that has been used in China to describe these technologies. They're known as leap ahead technology. Something that is a silver bullet that would allow China to counteract the vast military superiority of the U.S. And it really dates back. Its desire dates back in the modern era to the Gulf War, the original Gulf War. When we rolled over Saddam's forces in the early 90s, China was really shocked because, in some ways, their army is kind of like Saddam's was—a large conventional army. They have a lot of men under arms. They have a lot of tanks. They have solid but not really up to date technology. When they saw that with our stealth technology, with our satellite-guided munitions and so many other high-tech armaments, we were able to really just roll over them. It was a wake-up call, and they determined to find the ways that they could get ahead, and they're really looking for these you know, silver bullet technologies to do it.
So in the words of Mao many years before, this was an attempt at a great leap forward.
A great leap forward. And, you know, that is not really a coincidence. What a lot of people don't know about the great leap forward was that it wasn't simply a misguided effort to reorganize agriculture in China. It was a period in which a huge amount of China's food production was exported to the Soviet Union in order to get nuclear technology. And that's how China got the bomb, by literally starving their own people. Hopefully the current government isn't quite as determined as Mao was, but this is a tradition that goes back generations.
So are these spies paid a lot of money?
No, not necessarily that much money. I mean, Bill Mu stood to make maybe $1 million on this deal. But in a lot of cases, we think that social networks are really being brought into play. So eventually there's some kind of payment, but these don't seem to be cases that are purely driven by money.
So it's also do something for the homeland. But in the case of Bill Mu, he was his connections were to Taiwan, and Taiwan is a major part of this whole story.
Well, one thing that we learn in Simon Cooper's report on this story is just what a shady world the whole international arms market is. And the U.S. has sought out these arms deals around the world, and then when they kind of go sour, maybe we shouldn't be so shocked, and maybe we should exercise a little more control, even with our allies, because that's how some of this stuff has emerged.
Well, haven't we been caught in a bind? On the one hand, we use arms sales as a diplomatic tool, but also it's a major source of income for the United States. It cuts down on the trade deficit. And then when you give some people these arms, in the past we always said we give them slightly lesser things, not the latest. But in the end, it doesn't take all that much to figure out how to upgrade them, as the Israeli military has learned.
That's absolutely right. And there is a real contradiction in our own policy. The Commerce Department, which on the one hand wants to restrict technologies that might have military applications, is also charged with encouraging high-tech trade, specifically high-tech trade in areas like aviation that have strong military applications. So the very same companies might be both kind of giving with one hand and withholding with the other.
And we have a very ambivalent attitude toward China, don't we? We want to encourage trade. After all, we have a major deficit in our trade relations with them. On the other hand, we consider them a potential enemy.
Well, we like to think that the growth in trade is an incentive for stability and for non-confrontational approach. And I think in the U.S., we tend to see China as a strategic partner on some level, or we hope to achieve that. But are they really a strategic competitor? And I think in China, the viewpoint is very long range, and there's a strong desire to be able to counter the United States, to be able to stand up credibly if an event were to flare up, particularly over Taiwan.
Well, how does this apply to protection of our secrets in other ways? For example, if we share certain military secrets with the British or the French, we assume that those secrets will end with those militaries. But as we've seen in the Pakistani nuclear project, there are some people who are ready to sell these things to everybody, and I'm not sure that China isn't in the second group.
Well, China is in the second group. I mean, there's really no question. And some of this technology flows like water on the international scene. In fact, some of the missiles we're seeing that Iran has supplied to Hezbollah have, we believe, have some element of Chinese technology in them, especially the Fajr 3 rockets, their most advanced rockets that they've unveiled recently. And there may be more to come. And China may see this as a powerful wedge that they can use to enhance their influence in the Middle East.
I just saw a documentary that takes place in Iraq, and some Australian security men are buying AK-17s from Kurds, and they have a choice of the Russian AK-17s and the Chinese, and they say, we'll take the Russians because you can't trust the Chinese. So is there another problem there that the Chinese don't always keep the kinds of maintain the kinds of standards that one would expect when you're dealing with sophisticated things like this?
We don't know that, actually. I would expect that if you see where China's headed in other high-tech industries, including the automotive business today, they're going to catch up very, very quickly to the standards of their competitors.
So what happens because we are caught in this odd, ambivalent situation with China, what happens when we catch somebody like Bill Mu? What kind of sentence did he get?
Well, Bill Mu got a relatively stiff sentence, something on the order of close to 3 years, I believe, in a deportation order. But in many cases, and one of the real concerns here is that because of the ambiguous nature of some of this technology, a lot of these people get off with surprisingly light sentences, probation in some cases. And partly that's because we have the sense that they're not lifelong professional spies, but it lowers the risk, and it perhaps makes it easier for China to be able to recruit these agents.
And during the Cold War, spying meant really long terms or trades. I don't know whether China is ready to trade people with us because we've arrested spies like Bill Mu.
And China could argue that they don't work for them. You know, there was somebody selling them a product, they could argue that credibly.
Wasn't the U.S. case also hurt with something like the Win Cho Lee incident where it's likely that he was not spying for
exactly.
China?
Exactly. Win Cho Lee, the engineer at Los Alamos, who was very, very publicly accused of some sort of espionage with China, and then has launched a very vigorous and successful counterattack on the press in part. That's often raised by defense lawyers who are involved in these cases as an example of, is there a witch hunt? Is there bias against people of Chinese background? And I think it's always a legitimate concern, but that in any kind of law enforcement, but the But I think that also that might have led to a certain conservatism, a little bit more care. And if it's more care about divulging an ongoing investigation, that might be a good thing. But if it's a reluctance to pursue an investigation, that might not be so good.
Well, Bill Moo was caught in a sting operation. Is that generally what's happening?
That's not so typical. And that's one of the reasons that case was so noteworthy. But we also noticed, and Simon Cooper really pulled this out, there have been, we looked at over a dozen of these cases, many of which have been prosecuted. They don't get much attention. They don't get much press because individually they seem like fairly low-level operations. It's only when you put them all together and you see how massively widespread this is. We're just looking at the U.S., but as you mentioned, with international arms trades, there is technology all over the world that China can also get their hands on.
And there are some of those munitions lists are a lot more limited in other countries. They probably are very happy to sell China certain things that the U.S. might consider just going too far.
Right. And in some cases, you know, we talked about at the high end, an F-16 engine or a nuclear submarine or cruise missile. But at the low end, it might be something as simple as night vision equipment. You know, if they can get their hands on night vision equipment that's a couple of generations more advanced. Black Hawk helicopter engines, things that are relatively routine in the U.S. military, but have still not filtered around the world to that degree.
My guest is Jim Meigs, who is the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics magazine. They have just published an article called China's Secret War, written by Simon Cooper. And we will continue our conversation right after this. We're back with Jim Meigs, the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics magazine. In their current issue, the August 2006 issue, there's an article called China's Secret War, written by Simon Cooper, but also a collaborative effort, you say?
Well, anytime you have a magazine project, we bring a lot of fact-checking to bear. But the real work and the uncovering of this pattern was Simon's, it was really his insight that this pattern is so widespread.
When did Popular Mechanics start doing this sort of thing?
Well, you know, Popular Mechanics has been around since 1902.
And yeah, but I remember it was always for guys who wanted to put radios together.
Well, that, yeah. But it also, you know, back in the 60s, it covered the space program. It covered the controversy over the anti-ballistic missile. I picked up a copy from 1914 not long ago and saw an excellent analysis of what went wrong in the Spring Hill mine disaster, which, of course, is one of the worst mine disasters in American history. The magazine has always wrestled with the implications of technology and major issues in our society that have a scientific or technological component.
But today we have a different situation than we did in the past. Globalization is a buzzword. Some people see it as a bigger problem than others. Some see it as the solution to all the world's problems. I'm sure that it applies in this case, doesn't it?
In some ways, we're seeing the globalization of arms. You know, Thomas Friedman has that famous idea that the world is flat. Well, in the military arena, it's also getting flatter. You know, military superiority used to depend on who could build the most and the biggest battleships. It required enormous investments in steel and energy. Today, it might be who can program the microchip. So once you get your hands on that microchip or you get your hands on that program, you don't need massive factories to the same degree to catch up. So it's easier to level the playing field with this kind of espionage.
As we're seeing now in Lebanon, where Hezbollah has a lot more sophisticated missiles than Israel or anyone else ever thought that they could have.
And I think that some of that technology is certainly coming in through Iran and influenced by China. But also, missiles are very decentralized. You know, you don't need an airport. You don't need F-16s. You don't need AWACS. You just can fire a missile off of a neighborhood. And as China perhaps disseminates some of this technology more than we would like, we may be seeing this as a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, China has nuclear capability, but how close are they to having a nuclear-capable cruise missile?
Well, we don't know if they're at all close to a cruise missile. We do know, and this one thing that really surprised me, is that they're very close to ICBMs that could strike the United States, and possibly within a couple of years of submarine-launched nuclear weapons that could strike the United States.
So they haven't been sharing that information with the North Koreans, who were incapable of sending off a missile very far?
The North Korean missile launch blew up. But let's all remember that as Tom Wolfe so famously said in The Right Stuff, in the early days of our space program, all our missiles blew up. And, you know, you learn a lot from a missile test that doesn't work. We don't know how far along they are. We really don't know how much China has shared with them, but there are strong suspicions that they've shared a good deal.
What percentage of China's GNP is spent on the military?
Well, China is a has a massive investment here, and it is a and because their economy is growing so fast that even as the that percentage, even if it goes down, represents a massive growth in their total investment. And we really believe that they're taking a long-term strategic view here. You'd think that in a relatively peaceful time in their neck of the woods, compared to the mid-20th century, they would be content to let the money roll in and the economy grow. But in fact, they're really diverting considerable resources here.
Anybody have any inkling as to why? The only explanation would be that at some point they assume they're going to be going to war.
Well, there's kind of two theories on this. One is it's all about Taiwan. And we, of course, it's no secret that they want to reintegrate Taiwan with mainland China. And they've been very clear about that. And that at a certain point, they may want to compel that move by force. And, you know, at some point, our Navy will be sailing into the Western Pacific. Their Navy will be sailing out to meet us. They want, the argument might be that they want to be able to be able to intimidate us enough to say, Taiwan's not worth it. That's one theory. The other theory...
But I want to talk about that a bit further, because this has been a major source of tension for a long time. I remember the first Taiwan Straits crisis that involved, if you remember, Kamoi and Matsu, mm-hmm. and that involved lobbing missiles as well.
Yes, and China has been known to lob the occasional threatening missile and do missile tests routinely.
Although that was based on what they perceived as a threat from Taiwan and the United States against them.
Yes,
I guess that was 54 or so.
But in the intervening years, the equation of power has grown dramatically lopsided. So what will get China active is statements that sound like a move towards separatism on the part of Taiwan. Or actions that are perceived as being too aggressive on the part of the U.S. I think the U.S. policy has always been, let's just see if we can hang on to the status quo as long as possible. And I think China's view is that they want to be able to start tipping that balance.
Why do you think Taiwan is so important to China? Hasn't China survived quite nicely without Taiwan for nearly 60 years now?
You know, that's the way it looks to us here in the U.S. I think it looks very different to them. And there's an argument that China has, there's an element in the current Chinese leadership that is inclined towards a real view of an imperial view, a view of empire, and that's a word that is often misused today. But the idea that it is their destiny to play a controlling role in world affairs, at least in their hemisphere.
And America has pledged to defend Taiwan. We have all sorts of treaties that commit us to that. So there is the possibility that there could be a war that sucks the United States in if China decides to go in and forcibly take back Taiwan?
Well, that's what our treaty says. I think there a lot of people today aren't sure whether we would go all out. But we certainly pledged to do so in our treaty relationships with Taiwan. But again, the bigger question is it more than Taiwan? Is it the desire to be a kind of a global powerhouse and broker of in a whole range of areas? And if you look at the arrangements China's made with Iran and other countries to try to lock up natural gas, oil, resources, you do see a little bit of a kind of almost a 19th century style of maneuvering. And having a big stick to wield in those situations might be seen as a plus for that.
China also has a real presence in Africa, in places where the Soviet Union used to try to apply some influence.
Well, you know, it used to be a bipolar world. And as the Soviet Union collapsed, there was something of a power vacuum. We've seen that lead to instability in some areas. We've seen it lead to growth of democracy in other areas, probably a net increase in democracy. But maybe China sees itself as filling that role. We hope not as confrontationally and perhaps not as ideologically, but there is a strong sense that they do see a global role for themselves.
Well, I've spoken to a number of people about this, and it's interesting. I get two opposite answers. I get answers that are similar to what the U.S. Department of Defense says about the Chinese military. It says it's languishing perhaps 25 years behind the states in a number of areas. And that, I guess, is despite the stealing. So we really don't have much to worry about for a while. And by the time we would have to worry about something, China will have changed. It'll be transformed just because of globalization. And others are saying, no, we should really be scared of China. China is the next great threat, I guess, which also makes some people feel like we're doing the yellow peril thing all over again.
Right. And I think that even a lot of people who are quite concerned about this pattern of Chinese spying, many of them want to stop short of an all-out Cold War mentality here, that we do have an enormous amount of trade with China. The economic ties between the U.S. and China are vast. Any kind of war would wipe that out overnight. And certainly there's the hope. You know, the flip side of that Thomas Friedman idea is that creates a powerful incentive for diplomacy and stability. But these two ideas aren't totally in sync, and maybe they're not in sync in China either.
Because China right now, for example, wants to bring its cars over to the United States. In a couple of years, we'll probably be buying inexpensive cars that will compete against the South Korean cars.
Absolutely. And, you know, when South Korean cars came in, the idea is they were almost a joke in terms of quality. In our test at Popular Mechanics, the South Korean cars are doing extremely well and offering a lot of technology and safety at low prices.
The Hyundai.
The Hyundai in particular, the Kia. China's next. We're expecting those cars to be pretty high quality. They may be suspiciously close to other designs you see on the world market in their technology, but we're expecting even lower prices, high quality. This is a pattern that is repeated again and again.
Well, we saw it with Japanese cars. The original ones were very close to other people's cars, and now our cars, we ask ourselves, why can't we make cars as well as the Japanese?
And to be fair, in many cases today we do, but the perception was ingrained that about Japanese quality. But you do see these things are fluid. Now Japan competes against these well-made Korean cars, a competitor they didn't take too seriously at first.
My guest is Jim Meggs, who is the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics magazine. We're talking about an article called China's Secret War, which is in the August 2006 issue of his magazine. You've been talking about Black Hawk helicopters. How did China get Black Hawk helicopter engines and night vision equipment? You just don't take a helicopter apart and ship it piecemeal to China.
Well, you do. You can, actually. That's the funny thing. Some of the components we're talking about are so small, you can literally buy them legally in the U.S. They're restricted for trade with China, but what's to stop you from dropping it in a padded envelope and mailing it to your friend in Beijing? It can literally be that simple. And in a lot of cases, what we've seen, it's sort of like that old Johnny Cash song about building the car one piece at a time. What we've seen is in some of these areas, we believe that the technology was picked up piecemeal. Occasional big scores like an engine, but in many cases for guidance, avionics, all kinds of other parts, other components, these things were obtained in very, very scattered, decentralized operation.
A South Korean arms dealer was convicted last year of exporting Black Hawk engines to China.
That's one of the convictions that we looked into, and as I said, that's one of the relatively rare, kind of crystal clear cases. And what's disturbing about it, and I think what even the people who are involved in enforcement will tell you, we don't really know how many we didn't catch. And even in the case of a character like Bill Mu, they don't know how much information and technology he traded with China before this incident came along. He was very well established in the arms trade.
Why do they want Black Hawk helicopters so much?
Well, what China needs to do is they need to diversify their military. We know they've got huge numbers of men. We know they've got lots of tanks, but they don't have the flexibility that the U.S. has. Their aviation assets are way behind ours. So they're working on a new prototype jet fighter. You know, currently in the world today, the U.S. has nobody. There's nobody that really is a credible enemy in large numbers. The Indian Air Force is quite good, but they're an ally. There are very, very few places in the world today where we would fly into a high-tech threat that would be sustainable over more than a few days. At least that's the view of a lot of people, even if some people do have some pretty good planes. If China could build large numbers of a jet that's competitive with the F-16, that would really reduce one of our big advantages, which is the air war and stealth weapons that that can be employed even in a case where there are no ground troops involved.
It was assumed during all the years after World War II, during the Cold War, that if there was a war, it would be with the Soviet Union. It turned out the only war we fought against the communist country was with China when we fought in the Korean War. The Chinese held us to a stalemate.
That's true. Yeah, and
the MiG fighters were pretty good.
The MiG fighters were very good. I mean, this was a period, the MiG fighters, that was Russian technology, and those were some really impressive little airplanes that were, and it was shocking, really, how good they were, and the military had to catch up fast, which they did.
So if we have another war with China, unlikely, but, you know, it is possible. Instead of fighting against Russian technology, we'll be fighting against American technology.
That's exactly the fear.
We'll be fighting against our own sophisticated weapons.
Oh, and against our own, two things. Against our own sophisticated weapons, and also, in some ways, against our own open society. I mean, we are willing to share information about technology. Our academics and scientists and engineers, we're not really accustomed to keeping secrets. We're not that good at it. And I think that China's exploiting that openness to some extent. I think most of us wouldn't want to sacrifice that openness completely, but here we're seeing that it does have its risks.
So what happens when American diplomats confront China with accusations of this sort?
This is such a good question. And I think that we're seeing different priorities in different branches of the government. Certainly, I think the State Department needs China's cooperation on North Korea, so many other areas. They're barely getting it from what we can see in a lot of corners of the world. But the Defense Department is quite concerned. The Commerce Department is kind of torn between conflicting agendas. I don't think there is a unified policy on this from what we can see.
And then we have different people who are advising us differently. For example, Henry Kissinger, who was a hawk for many years, he is a defender of Chinese policies.
Right.
Partly, I think, because he works for China.
Well, Kissinger has a lot of clients, so.
But I don't mean him in particular. Yeah. I'm sure there are many other people you would think would be on one side of the issue, but it gets more complicated.
Well, again, I mean, we're looking at technology at Poppin Mechanics, and there's obviously something to be concerned about here. But on a broader level, the fact that we're not in open conflict with a country that we used to be very much in conflict with at the heat of the Cold War, if I can kind of mix a metaphor, the fact that we're not in some kind of standoff position with them is a good thing. And the fact that American businessmen and Chinese business people are flying back and forth and trading and working on joint projects is a positive thing. So I don't think that this should be misconstrued to mean that all of that should be shut down. But there's an undercurrent here that's disturbing. And I think that with all the positive economic news going on, sometimes it's a little too easy to overlook that.
Well, if they're stealing it effectively, wouldn't it be better for us to just sell it to them and make some money?
You know, there are probably people who would advocate just that.
My guest has been Jim Meigs, M-E-I-G-S, who is the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics magazine. There is a big article called China's Secret War, A Spate of Recent Spying Cases Opens the Lid on China's Aggressive Military Buildup. What's most troubling, it is based largely on U.S. technology. The article is written by Simon Cooper. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really fascinating.
It's my pleasure.